you want to use a remote control?
Yes, I think I'll use that. Thank you very much, Yuka and Henrika, for inviting us all here and for putting together such an interesting collection of talks. Looking through the programme, there's some really fascinating and substantial issues that we're going to be talking about over the next 2 days. Now, there's a mystery here, and I'm entitling my talk The Enigma of the West. We have a compass point which is literally anywhere. It's unclear, and it's shifting. And its status as an identity is far from certain. Certainly, I've never really thought of myself as a Western person, and I've never been in many situations in which that term has seemed appropriate as a self-definition. But what an extraordinarily useful word this seems to be. The idea of the West is being sustained into the 21st century, or so it seems. And it's being sustained, as Yuka suggested, at both a mundane and at an abstract and geopolitical level. At a mundane level, one can hear discussions of Western flora and fauna, Western furniture design. There's all sorts of things, apparently, in our world which we can usefully describe as Western, or people find it useful to describe as Western. But also there are grander, more abstract themes. Western culture, Western philosophy, and Western critique, and particularly for people in the academic world, the relationship between the idea and the idea of the West and critique or self-critique seems to be particularly important. The Anglo-American writer Robert Young wrote once that critique is critiquing the concept, the authority, and the assumed primacy of the category of the West. In other words, he was defining the act of critique as the critique of the West. And certainly when I look around in the social sciences in my institution and would try and summarise what people are doing, it's very often that act of self-reflection, self-analysis, self-critique, centering on this category of the West, Western power, Western culture, that seems to be to the fore. So what we have here is an enigmatic, paradoxical concept. And I think that very mobility, the very flexibility, the very mysterious quality of the West is part of its power. It is because it is mobile and adaptable that it fits so many of our questions and so many of our answers, the questions and answers that we apply to the world. If it was more rigid, I don't think it would be able to do that. Some years ago, I wrote a paper about the transition from white to Western. It was particularly applicable to Anglo-American material, perhaps, but nevertheless, it is interesting because I was able to, I think, show how senior politicians at the start of the 20th century in certain countries talked about white civilization, white culture. And that term, that racial term, became redundant in the course of the 20th century. Part of the reason it became redundant is that it was too rigid, too fixed. People could not become white if they were living in Africa or China and so on. But they could become Western. White is a rigid, inflexible category. Western is a much more adaptable one. And that's just an example of the flexibility of this category of the West, which I think helps explain its relevance. Another example of this flexibility concerns religion. You don't have to be very old to remember a time when the West was associated with religion, and the category Western Christendom or Western Christianity was a familiar one. And these two terms, Western and Christianity, would often roll together. That was a time in which the West and the Soviet East were contrasted. Over the past two decades, the idea of the West as a secular, even an atheistic culture has risen up and been found to be useful. And I did a little study of the uses of these two expressions, the Christian West and the secular West, to see how often they've been used over the past few decades. And you can see the Christian West becoming popular, rising almost up until 1990 or so, and then declining, and then the use of the secular West taking off and becoming a key term. So much so that when we hear of organisations such as Boko Haram in Nigeria, usually translated as Western education is forbidden, we immediately know what that means. It means Western secular education is forbidden within an Islamicist organisation. So, another example there, I think, of this flexibility, and it's something I'm pointing to as an explanation of the usefulness of the West, but also the enigmatic quality of the West. It's the difficulty of pinning it down. So for the rest of today's presentation by me, I'm going to be doing two things. First of all, I'm going to try and look at the development of Occidentalism as a field of study. And then I'm going to look at what I'm calling the power of failure. And in both of these themes, I'm going to be following this idea of the enigmatic quality of the West. So I'm going to look at the uncertain development of Occidentalism as a field of study. And I'm going to be looking at the way that the West is constantly critiqued and challenged and seen as a problem or a failure is actually an explanation of why it's so useful and why it's so current in various parts of the world. In that part, I'm going to be pointing to quite a lot of examples from South and East Asia. So, Occidentalism. Now, there was a time when I thought that Occidentalism was going to be the next big thing, and maybe it is. So here's a few key English language texts. Well, got my one there as well. But anyway, the Occidentalism Images of the West in 1995, the one on the left, was an anthropological study. I think was a very important and very, very valuable collection. And it looked at the way the West is found useful in various parts of the world. One of the chapters I particularly like is about Japan and by Millie Crichton, and it looks at the way in Japanese advertising the figure of the Westerner is used when selling transgressive or otherwise risque consumer items, such as whiskey. So whiskey, alcoholic drinks, strong alcoholic drinks, would often be sold in Japanese advertising using a Western celebrity. The idea being that it was sort of unacceptable to use a Japanese person for such a role. So a nice working through of how an idea of the West is applied in a particular part of the world. But then the study of Occidentalism changed. And the book in the middle there from 2004 by Baruma and Margalit, Occidentalism, A Short History of Anti-Westernism, I think the title explains what the change was. Occidentalism became defined as those who hate the West. The study of Occidentalism, the study of why and where people hate the West. This is clearly a post 9/11 turn in this field, and it became a defining turn. So in order to wrest that conversation back to a more generous and less ideological set of interests, I wrote The Idea of the West also 2004, in which I tried to look at how different intellectuals around the world, in India, Japan, and China, for example, have defined their own culture's path to modernity in contrast to a notion of the West. So I was particularly interested in how, in the context of diverse or multiple modernities, the West is found to be a useful counterpoint. So I was trying to wrest the debate back to its anthropological roots a little bit, but in a way it was too little. The gears of geopolitics are much larger than one little academic monograph, and the sense that Occidentalism is concerned with people who hate the West, and we need to understand why people want to hate the West and why they want to drive aeroplanes into tower blocks in New York, is a kind of jet stream over this whole debate. But this doesn't exhaust what happened to the study of Occidentalism. I think it's very important to understand how this field has been taken up outside of the West, however we want to define that term. So one has institutes for Occidental studies in Saudi Arabia, in Turkey, and here at the University of National University of Malaysia. And this institute, ICON, which is the Malay anagram, and Occidental Institute of Occidental Studies there, as it explains in its preface here, committed to enhancing the understanding of the Occidental world from a non-Occident perspective. And a lot of these institutes for Occidental studies started outside of the West, were trying to do precisely that. They were trying to frame the West as this object, the idea being very much to sort of turn the epistemological tables. For a long time, the South and the East have been the objects of the West, West's study, and now the idea was, let's turn that around and study the West. Now, that does sound as if that might lead to a certain essentialism and a kind of us and them dynamic. And I think in some cases it has. But it hasn't stopped there. This Institute of Occidental Studies in Kuala Lumpur has been doing work, which I think is going well beyond that. And I'll just introduce the work of Shanta Venugopal here, and a couple of her books to illustrate this point. Well, you can see from the title there that clearly we've got a perspective from Malaysia and then the gaze of the West framings of the East. I'll just indicate what kind of work she's been doing. And I'll pull out 2 points from this. The first is that what Shanta's interest is the study of how the East perceives the West, perceiving the East. So a kind of chain, a kind of a set of mirrors, which goes far beyond just looking at the West and stereotyping the West in the same way they did us. So she's interested in that backwards and forwards process of representation. So quite a complicated ambition. The other thing I'd pull out of this introduction to her book is how she very quickly conflates the West with Anglo-America. Anglo-American for our purposes, she says. And at no point goes on to explain what the logic there is, what purposes these are behind this conflation of terms. But that kind of slippage, that kind of conflation very often happens in studies of the West. You find out, in fact, people are talking about a particular part of the world. In this case, it seemed to be Anglo-America. Okay, so what I've described is the taking off of a field, Occidentalism, Occidental studies, and we've looked at a number of different trajectories. They were from anthropology, they're also from geopolitics in the sort of post-9/11 studies of why people hate the West, but they're also from new institutes around the world which are taking the West as their object of study. So a diverse and vibrant field. And it still is. But it's not, if I'm honest, taken off in quite the way that I anticipated. Certainly, if I look at my library at the University of Newcastle, there are not just shelves, there's whole corridors of books on Orientalism and post-colonialism in terms of Orientalism. And the students, the undergraduates, they immediately get that. They understand Orientalism and they write about it endlessly. I've got piles and piles of marking on that topic. But I also try to get people to write about Occidentalism. And it's interesting just how tricky that is. And I didn't expect this when I first started writing about this, how difficult it was going to be to get students, undergraduates, postgraduates to take this up. For example, I've had a PhD student who went out to the Centre for Institute of Occidental Studies and studied there, doing a PhD on Malaysian ideas of the West. But when he asked people about their ideas of the West, they weren't sure what he meant. They found it a bit difficult to answer those questions. They kept asking him, what do you mean by the West? And then he asked himself, what do I mean? I don't know what I mean by the West. And he ended up changing his PhD to a study of the Malaysian media, newspapers. So that's one down. And now I've got another PhD student working in Manila on Filipino nurses' ideas of the West. The idea is to look at their migration patterns outside of the Philippines in terms of ideas of the West and the East. And she is sticking with it, actually. It's doing okay so far, but she's also coming back to this sort of problem of this nebulous category that people, when you ask them about the West, whether it's in Malaysia or the Philippines or anywhere, they often throw it back to you as a question. What do you mean by that? So this indefinite, enigmatic quality, I think, has been an issue in terms of the take-up amongst students at different levels. So that's interesting, I think, the way they get Orientalism, the way they get the idea that the West has done these bad things around the world, and that is part of their expectation, and feels solid to them in a way that study of the West doesn't. It kind of slips away somehow, and this may be because it's newer and more original, but it's also to do with, its enigmatic quality. And I'm not going to give up on my students. I'm, you know, the fact is that the West as a concept is still not just powering on, but it appears year by year to get more currency, more relevance, or people use it more and more to explain the world around them. It still powers on. And it powers on in some ways that actually tend to be marginalised a little bit, forgotten in the debate on Occidentalism, such as the concept of westernisation, which has got a little bit pushed aside in the drive to look at how the West is constructed or how we are living in a post-Western world. And if there's one book that I give my students that they immediately understand, it's this one, The World Revolution of Westernization. That seems to, you know, make sense. But I'm not just saying that in a flippant way, because I do think that westernization still is a useful category and may explain some of the continued pertinence of the concept of the West. So we have an idea which I'm approaching through this category of the enigmatic. And I said I was going to look at the rise of Occidentalism as a field of study, and then also what I called the power of failure. So now I'm going to move on to this second ambition here, to look at the power of failure. The book there on the left is from 2008, and it usefully summarises the zeitgeist. In a way, it's not just the kind of Eastern or Asian zeitgeist, but it's a bit of a kind of global zeitgeist these days, that we are entering or have entered the Asian century, and that the West is a residual culture and civilization. Now, there clearly is an enormous number of assumptions and expectations in this supposed shift. But it is a very important set of expectations and assumptions, and it hovers over a lot of these debates about the West. And it's also pertinent in terms of looking at the relationship between East Europe and Russia, for example, in as much as if we are going towards the Asian century, then the dynamic in Central Asia and Russia would be more towards the rising stars of alliances with the East rather than alliances with the West, becoming East-focused, as one has seen in Turkey and one has seen in Russia, is a consequence of these types of narratives about the new Asian hemisphere, the irresistible shift of global power to the East. So there's almost a kind of sense of natural progression there. And a lot of East and Southeast Asian authors who are writing about this do use quite naturalistic metaphors about the death of the West and the inevitable rising up, the flourishing of the East, and also the kind of inevitable nature of the return to power of a part of the world that was the preeminent power and then just lost that preeminence for a very short period during the rise of the West. So the reason I'm talking about the power of failure is that the connection of the West to all things that have gone wrong in the world, the connection of the West to a discourse of failure, to a discourse of exhaustion, or a narrative of violence and oppression, these kind of negative attributions are actually key to the way that the East and the West are being discussed. So this association appears to be one of the reasons that the concept of the West is being still found so useful in the 21st century. It's being used, the West, and the West, the failure of the West, is being used to explain our success, for example, in Asia. Now, this isn't an entirely new phenomenon. This association of the West with crisis, of the West with failure, I would argue, is actually foundational to the emergence of the concept. Now, that may be a rather generalistic claim, so I can make it a little bit more specific by saying that in terms of my studies of the use of the category the West in the British and American literature, it's clear that the concept was barely used until the late 19th century and then began to be mobilised. And if one is looking for its first major statements, they are all to do with the failure and crisis of the West. This is the first book in English about the West. Yes, and it's called The Doom of Western Civilization. You know, it's a little bit, seems a little bit previous, a little bit eager, you know, before a concept has even emerged, to say it's doomed. This thing is doomed, this Western civilization. There had been no books in English before this one, 1907, about Western civilization. And from that point on, there was a developing literature. But this theme of the crisis and failure of Western civilization was very important in that emergent literature. It was only 11 years after this that we had Spengler's The Decline of the West, perhaps the most famous example of this association of the West with failure, a book from 1918. And there's the epigraph of this little book, The Doom of Western Civilization, and it's a quote from Indian edition of the Times, setting out how flabby and complacent people in the West are these days, how they have no fighting spirit, how they are indeed physically weak, and how they are mentally unprepared for the challenges ahead, and how, therefore, this thing, this nascent, newborn thing, Western civilization, is inevitably going to be overwhelmed by, interestingly, by countries like India and China. So this notion of the Asian hemisphere is also something that isn't new. It also seems to be something that was part of the birth story of the idea of the West. The Japanese writer Tenshin Okagura, in a couple of years before this, actually, was writing about the awakening of the East. And the theme of the awakening of Asia, the rise of Asia, was important to this discourse of the decline of the West. One, a kind of old civilization, and now dying, another one, a young one, and now set to take over the world. Move forward 100 years, and we are saying, are hearing the same things. How long the West can be dying, I don't know. But it's been dying for 100 years, it's been doomed for 100 years. This isn't just some sort of coincidence. It's clear that these notions of failure and challenge and difficulty are integral to the ways that we find the term the West useful. Right, now I'm going to look at this in two ways, drawing on Southeast Asian and South Asian examples. And clearly these may be not parts of the world that you are studying, but hopefully there will be relevances that you can see. So these examples I'm going to be looking at are discourses about the West as a problem, the West as a failure. And they have an interesting contrast, because one is about the West as a problem because it's so soft and complacent and flabby, and one is about the West as a problem because it's so hard and instrumental and rationalistic and secular. And in both of these cases, the fact that the West is framed as this problem also frames the fact that we might be Asians or religious Indians or whoever we are the solution. So we become the solution by framing the West as the problem. I'd say, okay, so this is the first example, and like a lot of these themes about the flabby, complacent West, it's related to Asian values and gets some very clear representations from politicians and intellectuals from Singapore. And there's one example there, talking about the decay, the decline of the West. Again, flipping very quickly from the West over to the US and Britain because of their broken families. There's certain key themes that constantly come up in this type of representation of the West. Broken families, teenage delinquency, and in part female emancipation, gay rights, these sorts of themes crop up and are rolled together as a sort of discourse of decline. So the move away from the disciplined and the conservative, I suppose that is the key theme. The move away from the disciplined and conservative to something that is declining. And this is a quote from the ex-Prime Minister, but it's this man, Mabubani, who was a Singaporean ambassador to the United Nations and is now at the University of Singapore, who I turn to as the best exemplar and the most articulate exemplar of this type of discourse. So Mabubani is a very urbane, world-travelling person with a big audience in Southeast Asia and in the US. And the notion that the West is declining because it has incredibly generous welfare provision is key to what his message is. Only by cutting back on welfare and by having family-based welfare structures, in other words, if you are unemployed, then you go back to live with your parents or grandparents, Only through those sort of lean structures, which are family orientated, will we see economic success ever return to the West. And it's interesting that this message has got an audience not just in Southeast Asia, but in the US as well. So a lot of people believe this in different parts of the world. And as he says that only pride, only hubris can explain why so many Western societies are trying to defy the economic laws of gravity in the way I've just described. So this sort of narrative is used to legitimize neoliberal and quite disciplinarian governance. This notion of the West as this failing welfare-dependent problem is being used to legitimize this strict neoliberal forms of governance and very much family-orientated forms of governance as well. The family is the key social bond and structure. And they directly echo the kind of things that were said in the Doom of Civilization from 1907. And here's another quotation from Mahubani. I don't know if he uses the word flabby for the West, but he might as well do. The sense of these lazy, indolent Westerners who don't think they have to work hard runs throughout his explanations. And as I say, he travels around a great deal. He says in the second paragraph how personally shocked he is by how complacent and smug people in the West are, particularly their political intellectual masters. And he says he's tried to puncture their smugness. And also, interestingly, he has tried to convince them that they're no longer living in a mono-civilizational world, that there is a great shift towards a multi-civilizational world. But he says he hasn't been able to make that move yet. So this notion of the West as complacent, not competitive, is also associated here with this notion of the West as being insular, of being focused on its own problems and not understanding there's a great and wider shift going on. Okay, so this is one example of the construction of the West as a problem, as a failure, and how important that is in developing other notions, other categories around the world, but also an explanation of why the West is being sustained as such an important category into the 21st century. Mahubani wouldn't have hardly anything to write about if he didn't have this category of the West. It's interesting, in his books, they're all about Asian this, Asian hemisphere, Asian. He writes about the West. That's what he writes about. He doesn't write very much about the East or Asia at all. Partly, one suspects, because that would be quite difficult to generalise about. But the West is what he's interested in. It's the West is where he's passionate about. So this is my second example, and I'm turning to India now, and the, probably the most well-known to some people infamous Indian intellectual, Ashish Nandi. And he's infamous because, well, maybe that's too strong a word, but very unpopular in some quarters, because he's been very important in writing about the problems of secularism and the secular West. His anti-secular manifesto from 1985 was a kind of anchor document in this anti-secular or post-secular shift. And for Nandi, the West is a problem because it is rationalistic and technocratic and instrumental. It's a completely different representation of the West to what we just saw in Singapore and Mahubani. And he also makes the shift towards saying the problem of the West is our problem in India, because we have this middle class group in India and they are westernized, and they are our problem. They are our problem because they are westernized. The middle class Indian, he's constantly being accused by Nandi of being removed from the ordinary life of the people, of being secular, even atheistic in their approach to the world, of having kind of tick box approach to identity. And for Nandi, only by going back to a kind of old India of diverse spiritual identities, mobile spiritual identities, this is the kind of thing he really is drawn to, can we actually find the soul of India again? And he knows, Ashish Nandi knows he's being romantic, and he knows he's nostalgic, and he's written about these themes, about how intellectuals from the global south need to be romantic, and they need to be what he calls critical traditionalists to try and rebut the influence of the West through reference to tradition, whilst being critical about that process. So he knows he's a romantic, and he knows he's nostalgic, but nevertheless he makes the case that that is what one has to be in order to rebut the influence of the West. And maybe I haven't made clear why he's such a controversial figure. He blames religious violence in India on this westernized middle class. He says it's those people who are pitting religious groups against each other, and they're doing it because they find some instrumental political benefit in pitting ethnic categories against each other. He's also controversial because he's said that the traditional Indian practice of suti, where the wife of a deceased man will throw herself on his pyre, is explicable and can be justified. This is the kind of reason why he's a controversial figure. He's going back to tradition, not necessarily the kind of benevolent traditions that you might think of, but ones which are a serious challenge to human rights in India, suti and also caste as well. He's also got quite a lot of good things to say about the caste system. So the West, again, is being mobilised. And I guess if I was to draw connections between the mobilisation of Ashish Nandi and Mahubani in Singapore, it's being mobilised by conservatives. Not in a very straightforward way, but people who believe in some sense of an older order, and who are doubtful about Western liberalism, Western libertarian liberal values. All these writers would be very suspicious of those. There's a couple of quotes from Nandi, which I won't read out to you, but there we have this famous statement from 85, his anti-secularist manifesto. As I say, for him, the secular and the West are almost the same thing. To be Western is to be secular. And how does he define secular? It almost becomes atheistic. He rolls those things together. And at the top there, he's making the case for being romantic and constructing the ordinary people of India as these innocents who should be saved from the Western middle class. Okay. So these examples show us how the West is very important to narratives of change in the late 20th and 21st century. They're ironic and it's paradoxical because they construct the West as this failed category, this problem. But nevertheless, that link seems to be one of the reasons why the West is so important, why it's being sustained into the 21st century. And it's being sustained for very different reasons, clearly. And it's not a question, I don't think, of saying, well, one of these narratives is right and one of them is wrong. It's more a question of thinking, showing, discussing how useful the West is, how it is being sustained across the world, how it's continuing in its pertinence, how this category, which some people would have thought would have disappeared, say with the end of the Soviet Union, is not disappearing at all, but appears to be growing in application, in the number of times that it is referred to, the number of times it is referenced to explain what's going on. So it's an odd, enigmatic, fascinating concept. I'm so glad that we've been brought here to talk about it over the next 2 days. I look forward to sitting in our discussions and seeing where we go. So maybe I'll stop there and we can have a few questions. Yep.
Okay.